He was inspired by Johannes Brahms and considered to be the successor to Franz Liszt. He was an amazing pianist, an amazing composer, educator. He came from Hungary, and you're going to find out more about Ernst von Dohnányi in this week's edition of New Classical Tracks with the Nash Ensemble. I'm Julie Amacher. This is American Public Media. Ian, let's start off by having you tell me a little bit about yourself, because I know you come from a very musical family. I remember your sister, the late Iona Brown.
Yes.
And don't you have a brother, Timothy, who also plays horn?
Yes, my brother was a principal horn in the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And I have a younger sister, Sally, who was a viola player in the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. And both my parents were professional musicians. So it's quite a clan of professional musicians.
So they kind of set the stage for you? Was that just sort of a foregone conclusion that you all would follow in their footsteps? Or you?
Well, not. I think they were very sensible, actually, because they gave us a great sort of love of music and enthusiasm for it. But they never rammed it down our throats and always, you know, made it clear if we didn't want to do music, wanted to do something else, that was fine. So I think they got the balance fairly right there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Nash Ensemble, which is the resident chamber ensemble at London's Wigmore Hall. And you joined this ensemble, what, 40 years ago?
40 years ago, yes. And 40 years ago this in May. So, yes, I've been the pianist ever since. It's a group of mixed chamber music with wind, strings, piano and harp. And then we even add to that, say, for contemporary music with brass and percussion. But the basis is 12, so it's very nice that it means we can do a very wide repertoire of different pieces involving all those instruments.
Now, the ensemble itself was formed in 1964, so you celebrated your 50th anniversary just 4 years ago. And I know that the mission, the goal of the Nash Ensemble originally, was to offer an opportunity for students at the Royal Academy of Music in London.
Yes, indeed. It was formed then by Amelia Friedman, who is still the director-programmer of the ensemble. And she was then a student at the Royal Academy, and she got lots of players around her, and they played all sorts of repertoire. It was also, I think, her a big interest of hers at the time was contemporary music, so she wanted a group which would do quite a lot of contemporary music and give a chance again to young composers at the time to have their music performed. But then after that, it became not specifically a contemporary music group, but we cover really the whole gamut of repertoire from Haydn to the present day.
And that's actually one of the specialties of this ensemble. You can play Haydn, like you said, but you can also play lesser-known composers and newer composers.
Yes, absolutely. Every year we commission works from contemporary composers, and we play regularly repertoire of works we've commissioned in the past. So it makes it a very interesting job and a varied musical diet.
And is that one of the reasons that you've stayed there for 40 years?
Yes, I think it is, actually, yes. Because in any chamber music group, people come and go. But somehow, because of that variety, it's very much suited what I want to do myself musically. So I've stayed with it. I also do quite a lot of other things, but the Nash Ensemble has been the basis of my playing all those years.
And where does the name come from?
The Royal Academy of Music is situated just by Regent's Park in London, and Regent's Park is well known for the grand architecture of John Nash, the 18th century architect. And at the time, Amelia was living at her parents' house, which was in one of those grand blocks, as it were. In fact, she originally wanted to call it the Royal Academy Ensemble, but they didn't want that, so she thought, OK, the Nash Ensemble is, it's a good name and it has very artistic connotations and so on. And all the early rehearsals of the group took place in this apartment in the Nash Terraces.
You've made more than 60 recordings with this group, and your latest features chamber music by a Hungarian composer. We have always pronounced his name Ernst von Dohnányi, though I see you have it a little bit different here. So are there a lot of variations of his name?
Yes, his Hungarian name is Erno, but I think he wanted to be associated with the German history, the German musical history. So he's normally, and he called himself, and he's normally still known as Ernst von Dohnányi. And the von in German means a sort of connection with nobility. And so his third wife and his widow, who wrote a biography, described how the family was ennobled in the 17th century. So they liked this von in the middle of their name.
He has a fascinating history, and it's one that I doubt is heard very often. In his early 20s, he was one of the virtuosos of the world when it came to the piano, and he caught the attention of Brahms early on. So Brahms was a huge influence for him.
Brahms was a huge influence, especially at the beginning. Brahms and Liszt were great influences. Of course, he was very much thought of himself as the successor to Liszt because he was a fantastic pianist, also a composer, also a conductor. But probably in terms of influence, musical influence, Brahms was the stronger influence. But it's interesting that it is quite Brahmsian music in a way, but you would never mistake it for Brahms. It's not just copying. He has a very individual voice, I think, especially harmonically. There's always little harmonic twists and chromatic twists in his music, which are very characteristic of Dohnányi.
Now, I want to talk about the specific pieces on this recording. However, I also want to touch a little bit on what happened to him during World War II, because that was a huge turning point in his life. There were rumors flying around that he was a Nazi sympathizer, and that really couldn't have been further from the truth.
No, I think people looking back feel that that was actually very unjust. And he was conductor of the Budapest Orchestra and head of the Budapest Academy, and he was evidently always very protective of the Jewish musicians working in the academy and working in the orchestra. So he really sort of stuck up for them, as it were. And even when the Nazis walked into Hungary, he was still very protective of Jewish musicians.
And then, of course, there's the issue where he lost both of his sons in the war, one of whom was Hans, the father of the well-known conductor Christoph von Dohnányi.
Yes.
And he was executed for collaborating in a plot to assassinate Hitler. I mean, this is a fascinating history.
It's an amazing history, yes, and obviously a very, very tragic history as well, yes. I think not very much is known about that in detail, but certainly, yes, he was executed by the Nazis.
So then Erno literally escaped Budapest on the back of a truck with his soon-to-be third wife, and eventually they landed in Argentina, and eventually then moving to the U.S. in 1949, where he taught at Florida State University in Tallahassee.
Yes.
So how did all of this impact his career? I mean, I know that those rumors followed him right to the U.S., though he was able to have a comeback at Carnegie Hall eventually.
Yes, I think that there was a feeling. He was actually interviewed by the U.S. military after the war, and I think the evidence against him being in collaboration with the Nazis was probably near to non-existent. But, of course, rumors stick. so that that sort of thing never goes away. So I think he did suffer from that, probably right to the end of his life. And when he returned to Hungary, there was a feeling that he never quite picked up where he'd left off. And that might have been part of the reasons that these probably completely unjustified assertions did actually affect his career. But as you say, he did have a comeback in later life, and he lived to the ripe old age of 83. So in later life, he was still having a career and playing and conducting.
Do you think that this is one of the reasons that his music sort of laid dormant for a while and then was revived in the late 1990s?
I think, yes, I think it very much could be. And it's nice that a certain number of his pieces are played fairly regularly, and two of them being on this Nash Ensemble recording. But of course, there's a lot of pieces, for instance, his orchestral works. He wrote the famous Variations on a Nursery Theme, which is undoubtedly his most popular work, and it's a wonderful piece, and it's wonderful orchestral writing. But other works, like the two, he wrote two symphonies and a marvellous suite for orchestra, violin concerto, are relatively neglected.
Let's talk about the pieces that are on your new recording, and I'd like to start with a string quartet number 3 in A minor. This is more of a nationalistic work. And I think it's one the composer really liked, which is a little bit unusual because he didn't often praise his own works.
No, he's very interesting, really. And it's very interesting to, of course, to compare him with his contemporary, the other great Hungarian composer, Bartók. And Bartók, of course, and Kodály, they were great nationalist composers, and they used a lot of material from folk songs, dances, and their music is very dominated by them. And Dohnányi, in a way, was more conservative. He liked the German romantic influence, and that was his way of expressing himself in a very intense way. But in this quartet, suddenly the lower strings set up very vigorous rhythms. Sort of like country peasant dances and so on. So there is this element in that piece. And the other element, of course, is that although he didn't break boundaries in a huge way, like, of course, Bartók did, but there's a good example in this string quartet, the first movement in the development section, where suddenly he feels like breaking the boundaries, and the work gets very much more enters the sort of 20th century musical language with very strong rhythms and sort of edgy tonality.
The Serenade for String Trio in C major is a very early work. And here we get to hear the composer's sense of humor, which I suppose is heard in many of his works, but it seemed to really come through in this serenade.
In particularly the scherzo, and the scherzo really bounces along very fast, with the themes being sort of thrown from one instrument to the other. But it's interesting, as you say, it's a very early work, but it's still considered, I think, quite generally, to be one of his greatest works, although he was only in his sort of mid-20s when he wrote it.
already we're getting a taste of those variations and his ability to write variations in this work.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's interesting that the variations in this piece are more sort of serious. Whereas the variations in the sextet are very, they're great fun, they're exploratory. You mentioned Strauss, there's a sort of imitation Strauss waltz in there. And there's a sort of imitation Bach. And so on. Lots of sort of styles which he touches on, and in a very nice way he sort of plays with different styles and says different things in very different ways.
And then we have the final piece. That's the one on which you are featured. The Sextet for Piano, Clarinet, Horn, and String Trio. And this is a really, it's a lush, wonderful work. It has a lot of different moods in it. We hear influences of Brahms and Strauss. Tell me about what we're hearing overall in this work, and maybe if you also have a favorite moment or two.
Yes, I agree with you. It's a marvelously sort of big, lush work, whereas a serenade and quartet are very much chamber works, and this is, although it's only six players, it's sort of verging on the orchestral in terms of the sound, and it's very good with Dohnányi because he was a virtuoso pianist himself, but he also found a way of writing, particularly for strings, in a very virtuoso way. So a lot of this happens in the chamber music as well. And I don't want to trivialize it, but some of this sort of epic grandeur of the sextet reminds me of film music. You know, there's a grandeur about it. It could have been film music for Ben-Hur or a work like that. And I don't mean by that that it's superficial or light music. It's very serious, but it's very grand, and it sort of packs a very strong punch. I like almost most, I think, in this sextet is the slow movement, and it begins very sort of seriously and lyrically. And then the piano sets up a rhythmic pulse, like a sort of drum beat. And then there's this very grand theme over the top of that. Which is passed from the clarinet and the horn to the piano and then to the strings. And all the time this rhythm is going on underneath, and it builds up to a tremendous climax. ¶¶ it's a very impressive movement.
The final two movements are really powerful too, and I think that's where we're hearing certainly the influence of Johann Strauss, and there's some interesting rhythm changes that are happening there too.
Yes, he sets up movements of three notes against four so that the horn is doing a theme in notes which you count in four, and the piano is playing an accompaniment which you count in three. So they work, as it were, against each other. And then gradually it all emerges into one time. It's a very clever piece of writing. He was a real craftsman, Doc Nani. He was a real professional in writing things which were musically, rhythmically, and also instrumentally very effective indeed. And that's probably one of them. And this then leads into the very wild finale. Which has a lot of fugato, the theme being thrown between the instruments. A lot of virtuoso writing for all the instruments. Very exciting piece.
New classical tracks from American Public Media. With special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode, I'm Julie Amacher. Be sure to download other episodes of New Classical Tracks.